Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I will be your host for the hour. Today is the day we set aside for the U.S. to mark the birthday of the single most celebrated civil rights leader of the 20th century, Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King was a powerful and visionary force in the mid-20th century struggle for civil rights. By the time his life and career came to a premature and violent end, he had come to believe that only a more radical rupture with the prevailing social and economic order would guarantee rights and freedom for all people. But year after year, his legacy is celebrated primarily in a sanitized version that's designed to not disturb the status quo. Here on the Old Mole, we want to be part of remembering, not erasing, what MLK had to say about the systemic nature of social and economic injustice and the radical changes that are needed in order to create a more just society, the changes that we have yet to make happen. Later today on the Mole, I want to share with you excerpts from an article by Jen M. Jackson, who argues for reclaiming the radical legacy of MLK. We'll also hear poet June Jordan reading her own poem, In Memoriam, for Martin Luther King, Jr. In their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker will provide a retrospective of the legal battles of 2021 with an emphasis on the fallout from the Black Lives Matter movement and the Native American use of treaty rights within the climate struggle. To begin our show, Bill Resnick speaks with Malik Mia, who spent years in the trenches of labor activism while writing prolifically on the manifestations of racism in modern American society and culture. Today, Bill and Malik take up the current right-wing assault on the teaching of critical race theory.
Hi, Malik Mia. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much, Bill. I'm glad to be here.
Malik Mia is a longtime civil rights and revolutionary socialist activist, made his living as an aviation mechanic, co-wrote the books The Assassination of Malcolm X and Angola, The Hidden History of Washington's War, also contributed a chapter to the book The National Black Independent Political Party, An Important Step for Blacks and Other American Workers. He's now a contributing editor with Against the Current on the advisory board of LINX, the International Journal of Socialist Renewal. He has published several pieces recently in Green Left Weekly and also Against the Current, and recently published an article, Why Critical Race Theory is Important. So, Malik, what is critical race theory? Then we can discuss how the right wing and the Republican Party have come to use it for her purposes and often succeed. But first, give us the story of critical race theory.
Yes. Well, critical race theory is mainly a legal concept that was discussed and taught in law school going back to the 1980s. And those who presented this idea, it actually was at a workshop in 1989 that they used a term that was actually existed before that, the concept, that all the laws and legal institutions of the United States are rooted in structural and institutional racism. What that means is that the structural racism is to maintain the privileges and advantage of the whites over other non-whites or African-Americans and others. And you can see it in social, economic, and then political inequalities. So they looked at it from the legal point of view, the laws that have been adopted over the decades and centuries, and how that reflects that structural inequality. So that was the basic concept, and then the debate was on that level. It only became a political football, which we'll talk about recently, but that was their basic idea, which, you know, anyone who knows the history of this country knows that's actually true.
My sense is that the ideas of critical race theory have picked up by many others. In fact, they originated in much other research in the social sciences. That often happens in the law. I happen to be a lawyer and know that historians of the United States have done a huge amount of excavating. and the lawyers have just then used that to begin examining the laws. So it's been picked up by social sciences to greatly enrich critical race theory by doing specifics. And let's get concrete about it. Tell us about some of the hidden sources of racism, hidden but extremely damaging in U.S. life today.
Okay, well, there's several topics, but we can begin with real estate, because real estate historically in the United States is the way that many farmers, poor workers, and others, if they could get land or property, was a way to start to accumulate what is called wealth. And historically, the right to buy land and property was African Americans or blacks were excluded from that for the most part legally, and definitely other people. You know, Native Americans were not even considered people, and for the most part. So they always say, well, if racism exists, you know, it's not because black people couldn't accumulate it because they didn't own homes or that. They decided not to. But in fact, it's been shown by historians, and I'm glad, Bill, you made that point, by studying concrete situations like urban areas and even farmland, how African Americans were excluded from owning land. And therefore, how could you accumulate wealth to pass on to your family and future generations when they wouldn't let you do it? And I'll be very concrete right now. Recently, just last week, the New York Times wrote an article about Central Park and how there were blacks who owned land in what became Central Park. And then the land, this is back in the 1800s, was taken from them to build Central Park. Now, that land would be worth millions today, but they were basically urban removed. Many people are familiar what happened after World War II with urban removal to build the freeways, and they always went through black areas, historic black areas, or Latino areas to build their freeways and take away their land or property, or even if they own homes. That definitely happened also in California, where I live. So the laws were written, redlining, as they called it, prevented certain blacks from living in certain areas, but even when they tried to buy real estate or bought land, they were removed because laws were passed to say, oh, we need this freeway or we need this park. And it was always targeted toward minorities for the most part. It affected poor whites too, but not like it targeted African Americans. That's a very concrete example of how structural racism and laws work hand in hand. Laws were written to justify political decisions to discriminate against blacks on real estate.
Yeah, laws have also been written to forbid discrimination in housing, that is racial discrimination in housing, and then I think they were expanded to include discrimination against women and religious discrimination, even the disabled. But despite that, what the sociologists find when they send in equally presentable black and white people responding to an ad, that is, it's an experiment. They go to the rental brokers. They find that it's overwhelming that the white person is really considered and then given a home once they talk to the landlord. And the blacks are steered only to landlords in black areas. And in fact, those laws seem not to have any teeth unless they were really enforced, but they aren't.
Yes, Bill, and that's an important point, because the most significant law on housing discrimination was adopted by Congress in 1968. Before 1968, it wasn't even an issue. You just were discriminated against. And part of the people who were the theorists of racial, you know, critical race theory looked at those laws. Okay, you passed a law in Congress, states adopted many similar laws around the country, but immediately how they were applied continued to be discriminatory. So, for example, on housing discrimination, while if you did it openly and just said, I will not rent or sell to a black person, that was illegal. But if you did it, you know, like you said, okay, I'll take your application or a real estate company, I'll look at it, and then they would just put it aside, put it in a separate basket, and wait till a white person comes. So that's how that happened. But then let's say you're in Washington, D.C., or a city that's predominantly black, or in Virginia or Maryland bordering D.C. Well, you can make sure those suburbs still discriminate even with this law. You can make it clear that, okay, the identical home could be priced lower in a black area than a white area. So you steer black area, not to the white area. Now, the house values should be the same, but they aren't. This is today. So that's how those laws were undermined, which is where critical race theory became important, because they explained that. How is that possible unless it's structural, unless it's inherent to the racism in the system? There's the connection.
One final issue that strikes me as hard to explain, it's within the medical system. I read a study of what happens when people wind up in a hospital with a stroke. And the first thing that the emergency room people have to do is give them some aspirins or a powerful aspirin substitute that stops clotting. And the hospital people are required to do this. It's just standard in practice for any stroke. Because they have to stop clotting, they give people aspirin. And yet, when you look at the records, white people get it almost all the time, and black people do get it most of the time, but not nearly the extent to which the whites do, regardless of class or race. How is that explained?
Bill, this is an important point, because you're getting into what I call the institutional racism built in our medical schools and our universities and all institutions we have. Certain things are not taught, or certain assumptions exist about blacks that even if you're not conscious of it, it's sort of unconscious bias. It's taught that way. So when you get into become a doctor or any field, you just bring those biases with you, and they're not checked. And I would also add, there's similar biases against women in medicine, because a lot of studies and tests never include women. They're mainly on men. And then you add the burden if you're a black woman, it's even worse. So that's where some of this comes from, which is why it's difficult, because how are you going to prove a negative? How are you going to prove something happened to you or a family member? It was because of that bias. It's hard to do, except, you know, later through studies. But that's the inequalities built into the system, these biases that exist, including in medicine. I did an article at the early stages of the pandemic about black women and how they're treated, including what happened to a black woman doctor and how she was treated. And they didn't listen to her when she was trying to explain what was going on. That was not unusual. It was not unusual. It didn't matter, like you say, if you were wealthy or you were educated, you were a professional, they treated a black person differently than a white. And that's the inherent racism that exists in the system that laws alone cannot fix. And part of what the people who promote critical race theory say is what I just said. What they don't say is, what do you do about it? Or very little about that. They just explain what exists. It's a problem we need to recognize. Most of them don't have really a solution because they accept the system as it is, meaning the for-profit system.
Hi, folks. This is your old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. Bill Resnick talking to Malik Mia. He's a long-term black rights and revolutionary socialist activist, made his living as an aviation mechanic, co-wrote a number of books, wrote hundreds of articles. The Republicans have now what they call weaponized critical race theory. They claim that critical race theory, and by that they mean any critique, actually, of whether it's of laws or any anti-racism curriculum in the schools, is really racist against whites, against America. They claim it preaches hatred and violence, and calls for elimination in schools. How have they managed to get away with that? Tell us about the Republican attack, Malik Mia.
Well, yes, Bill, this is an important point. Republicans are very good at demonizing many issues, and critical race theory is easy because most people don't understand what it is. So they define it as, if you tell people about racism, therefore you're telling whites they have to be, embarrassed, or they have to be take responsibility themselves personally for the history of racism in this country. And they repeat that over and over again, and it gets people to believe that anything about history, real history of this country, any discussion about blacks as slaves, which is a fact, segregation, which was a fact, is attacking white people. So they use that simple talking point to convince parents, especially in schools, to reject any discussion. And they go after school boards and principals and others who even mention this true history. So it's a political point. They're good at it. And because the people who oppose them are not, except for black, you know, the black professionals and social class, political class, have answered them effectively, but the mainstream Democratic white leadership and others don't. So they capitulate. They say, yes, yes, we should be careful how much we discuss this. Reparations, yes, that's not what we mean. So they, by backtracking, it encourages the right to go even further, to the point where they rewrite the textbooks to basically wipe out any mention of the real history. As one black student has said, you know, you go to school in Texas, and they'll tell you about maybe three black figures, Martin Luther King, maybe Malcolm X, Frederick Douglass. That's it. They don't talk about anything else in American history. And if the Republicans had their way, they wouldn't even mention those three black figures. So that's what this is about. It's a political game. They get people on the ground, and they whip up a movement, and the goal is ultimately to wipe out any of the social gains that African-Americans have made in this country. When they say turn back the clock, some people say, well, okay, it's weak. You weaken voting rights, you weaken housing discrimination. No. What they mean by returning back the clock, in my view, is going back at least to the era after World War I in the 1920s, where these type of laws, anti-black racist laws, anti-immigrant laws, you can go down the list, was the norm across all 50 states. That's what they want. They want a white America that was white-run, everyone knew their place, and you had to accept that. That's their goal. Now, the defenders of those opponents of this are not explaining it the way I do, for the most part. They just say, these people are minority. That's not true. The Republicans should go back to their roots. But that's not going to happen, because this is about a white majority that is declining. They use that cultural identity crisis for some, not all, for some, to whip up a political movement to attack all social gains that have been made the last 50 years. And that's their goal. And if we don't stop it, could we go to an authoritarian state as Trump tries? Yes, I believe it can happen. I definitely believe it could happen.
Mark, me, a longtime black civil rights and revolutionary socialist activist. Mark, we can't end on such a pessimistic note. It seems to me that the Republican effort could be stopped. To be sure, Trump or someone resembling Trump getting his blessing and putting together the same old right-wing white supremacist team, they could, in fact, prevail in the next election. And they're doing quite well in Congress and in the states and in suppressing the vote of poor people and working people. We'll talk about that in another interview, Molly. Tell us, what's your sense of the near future and what can be done to defeat the white supremacists and the Trumpists?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to recognize you're not going to defeat the authoritarian movement that Trump represents purely by elections or laws. You have to have a mass movement, mass response in the streets around these different issues that we've been talking about. in the 1960s, just a reminder, you know, we had a Democratic president, JFK, John F. Kennedy, and then followed by Johnson. And their main approach to the civil rights era movement, which was in the streets, fighting in the South to end Jim Crow segregation, fighting in the North where we had redlining and discrimination, was to basically tell King and others to slow down, to wait for them. And Martin Luther King and the Black Rights Movement basically said, no, we can't wait. They kept demonstrations. They kept protests. They kept going to the South. They had the March on Washington in 1963. All that mass pressure is what led the Democrats, who controlled the government completely, but it was split between the Southern Democrats, what are Dixiecrats, and the Northern Democrats. They finally pushed through those civil rights laws that are being undermined, voting rights, civil rights, and the housing rights. But that was the answer. The answer wasn't to say we got to wait to get more elected people in office. And this is important to remember. There were very few blacks elected to office in the 60s because you couldn't run for office for the most part. They were not elected like today. A lot more are elected. So they just kept the pressure on, and they challenged the state. And then you had rebellions in 67, 65, 67, 68, in urban areas. All that combined is what led to some of the changes in laws and changes that are important, that led to the revived women's movement, the gay liberation movement, other minority groups protesting. So it was through the mass struggle for basic democratic rights that led to change. That's what's missing today. We don't have that yet. We had the Black Lives Matter movement, which is still around, but not what it was in the 2020 protests. But that's what we need. If that happens, you can make progress. You can stop these attacks. You can defend it. If it doesn't happen, we're going to have to take more big setbacks. That's to finally galvanize that kind of movement. Will it happen? I'll give you a positive. In the last 6 months, we've seen labor organizations and unions start to fight back for better wages, better working conditions across the country, especially low-wage workers. Nobody could have predicted that. But labor, which has always been weak over the last 20, 30 years, is trying to get revitalized. A lot of those labor workers are blacks, Latino, minority workers, white workers who had enough. Now, that is important part of the picture that's not rarely talked about by the mass media, big business media. To me, that's an important sign that we can have the type of unity between all workers, whatever their race, to stand up to the bosses, and that can help inspire the broader social movements. So I believe that's the future. May not happen in the 2022 elections or even 2024, but that kind of mass movement is what will turn the tide.
Now, Mia, thanks so much for talking to us. As a conclusion, tell the people listening to KVU where your writing can be found.
Yes, domestically, Against the Current magazine out of Detroit. I write regularly for that. And then internationally, I write for an Australian paper called Green Left Weekly, at least twice a month, on various topics. I partly do that because they're one of the largest left publications in the Pacific, and their article, they get around. Some of my articles are also published in Europe. But the main domestic one is Against the Current magazine, and then those are the two publications I mainly write for.
Malik Mia, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, Bill. I enjoyed it.
Oh, I have ambitions, dreams. But dreams don't come cheap.
I saw a demon on my shoulders looking like patriarchy, like scrubbing blood off the ceiling and bleaching another carpet. How my house get on it? Why Toya and Body don't embody all the life she wanted? The baby just 19. I know I dream all black. I seen her everything. Immortalizing tweets, all caps. They say they found her dead. One girl missing, another one go missing. One girl missing another, but niggas in the back, quiet as a church mouse. Basement studio when duty calls to get the verse out. I guess the ego hurt now. It's time to go to work. Wow, look at him go. He really doubts to write about me when the world is in smokes. When it's people in trees. When George was begging for his mother saying he couldn't breathe. He thought to write about me. One girl missing, another one go missing. one girl missing another one. Yo, but little did I know all my reading would be about there is trans women being murdered, and this is all he can offer, and this is all y'all receive. Distract you from the convo with organizers. They talking abolishing the police, and it's a new world order. We democratizing Amazon, we burn down borders. This a new vanguard, this a new vanguard. I'm the new vanguard.
That was a little bit of the rapper No Name with her song 33. Before that, Bill Resnick and Malik Mia spoke about critical race theory as the current bugaboo for white supremacists. You are listening to KBOO Portland. June Jordan was a widely published Jamaican poet and playwright who was recognized for her lifelong commitment to political activism and human rights. Her poetry is fierce and pulls no punches in its exploration of issues related to gender, class, and race identity. She was known as a poet of the people. Jordan taught at a number of institutions of higher learning and ended her career as a professor of English, Women's Studies, and African American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. She passed away in 2002. Her poetic tribute to MLK is entitled In Memoriam, Martin Luther King, Jr. In the poem, Jordan presents a series of violent images leading up to the single word, America. The poem then continues with an even more percussive litany of destruction and horror until it lands on the single word, stop. The language then shifts to more peaceful and hopeful images, which, however, quickly give way to more violence, ending on the refrain of more and more and more. It is a poem of sorrow and outrage. Here is Jordan reading her poem.
This poem is in the memory of Martin Luther King, Jr. Honey, people, murder, mercy, USA, the milk lantern to monsters, teach to kill, to violate, pull down, destroy the weekly freedom-growing fruit from being born, America. Tomorrow, yesterday, rib rape, exacerbate, despoil, disfigure, crazy, running threat, the deadly thrall, appall belief, dispel the wildlife, burn the breast, the onward tongue, the outward hand, deform the normal, rainy riot, sunshine, shelter, wreck of darkness, derogate, delimit, blank, explode, deprive, assassinate, and batten up like bullets, fatten up the raving greed, reactivate a springtime terrorizing, death by men, by more than you or I can stop. They sleep who know a regulated place, or pulse, or tide, or changing sky, according to some universal stage direction, obvious like shore-washed shells. We share an afternoon of mourning, in between no next predictable, except for wild reversal, hearse rehearsal, bleach the black long lunging ritual of fright, insanity, and more deplorable abortion, more and more.
That was June Jordan reading her poetic tribute to Martin Luther King, Jr. A link to the poem is posted on the Old Mole webpage at kboo.fm. In January of 2021, following a year of unprecedented uprising against racist violence in the United States, Jen M. Jackson published an article in Al Jazeera entitled Martin Luther King Jr. Was Radical. We Must Reclaim That Legacy. Jackson argues that too much of what white America celebrates in the history of MLK obscures the way his politics evolved over time into a radical vision of a society that protects and serves the humanity of all. I want to thank Mole Sharon Grant for researching and editing this piece. If there was one Black American hero whose radical legacy seems the most fraught and contested, it might be King. It goes without saying that the political moment when King found himself coming of age was one that necessitated revolutionary change. Much like young Black people today, King's radical ideals were born out of intense social unrest and violence. Over his short life, King's political ideas and agendas evolved drastically, eventually moving away from integrationist politics to a politics rooted in Black liberation and freedom. But much of what we know about King's life and legacy has been filtered through a revisionist lens meant to make white people more comfortable with their own complicity in systems of white supremacy and anti-Blackness. Thus, many white Americans have reframed King's movement, work, and theorizing as a way to water down the true aims of the man who became significantly radicalized, pushed by Black activists and organizers around him, before he was shot and killed on April 4, 1968. While King believed that the fundamental tactics of mass mobilization and movement making for racial progress should focus on a nonviolent course of action, he also challenged activists and organizers to shift their focus to systemic and institutional barriers to progress for Black Americans. In 1968, just before he was killed, King said, "A riot is the language of the unheard." What we know of his legacy is that, while he did not support violent protest tactics, he believed that the only way to prevent rioting was to address the underlying concerns of those in the minority. King was clear that white people would not lead the revolution. Rather, it was always the voices of young, Black, and poor people that were most heard during times of great anguish and upheaval. Suffice it to say, King was not confident that powerful white people would work toward justice for all. Exasperated by the continued violence and economic disparity facing Black people, King had become disillusioned with the capacity for white leadership to be responsive to the political concerns of Black Americans. Most importantly, he had come to the realization that white Americans would frequently choose their own safety, liberty, and economic stability over the collective good of others. Towards the end of his life, King's ideas and work had made him increasingly unpopular. In 1966, 63% of Americans had an unfavorable view of King, up from 37% in 1963, according to Gallup. The precipitous change in public opinion about King in the 60s illustrates how his public politics and commitments became less palatable for white Americans not fully committed to the liberation of poor and Black people. Yet even as the public slowly turned away from King and his work, he continued to promote notions of class equality and Black humanity despite the risks to his own life and the lives of his family and comrades. It is the same fight we continue today. Young Black Americans have been in the streets fighting for their lives and for the safety of their communities. The protests after Breonna Taylor and George Floyd were killed by police have been described as the largest global mass protests in history. All of this in the midst of a global pandemic where Black Americans are at greater risk of dying due to COVID-19 than any other group. In general, Black Americans are at greater exposure for environmental risks. The global crisis has only highlighted the grave disparities in health and safety across racial groups. Even before the pandemic, Black women were at the highest risk of death due to childbirth complications, and Black children face higher rates of death from complications from asthma. We must acknowledge King's radical legacy in light of recent events. Not only that, we must consider how his evolving politics provide insight into the ways that young Black Americans today continue to be politicized and radicalized by the anti-Black world around them. His work shows that as the conditions of state-sanctioned persecution and inequality change, we too must allow ourselves to be changed. And when the world calls us to respond to oppression and repression, we must always concern ourselves with those least protected, least defended, and most vulnerable to the violence of the state. we should be suspicious of the watered-down, colorblind notions of King's politics that too often dominate mainstream narratives, and as white Americans continue to commodify and appropriate King's legacy for performative acts like the MLK Day of Service and other public displays, we must remember that this is the same MLK the FBI tried to convince to kill himself, only to tweet in his support decades later. Like so many of us who are committed to racial justice and accountability to those least among us, King's legacy is a balm in a moment such as this. King would have been fighting with and alongside young Black Americans following the deaths of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and so many others. And he would have seen the January 6 attempted coup as a toothless white supremacist attempt to grasp at the reins of power in the U.S., despite the immense damage this administration has already done. La, 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 la.
Hold on to me, don't let me go. Who cares what they see? Who cares what they know? Your first name is free, last name is dumb. But you still believe in where we're from. Man's white flower.
That musical clip was from the song entitled Freedom by Pharrell Williams. Before that was an excerpt from an article in Al Jazeera by Jen M. Jackson entitled Martin Luther King Jr. Was Radical. We Must Reclaim That Legacy. A link to the full article is posted on the Old Mole webpage at kboo.fm. To close our show this morning, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker in their Left in the Law segment offer a look back at the wins and losses in the U.S. legal arena from a progressive point of view. The courts, Mike argues, were a disaster, but we have lots to celebrate in the very important rise of progressive public prosecutors across the country in response to the BLM uprising and the effective use of treaty rights by indigenous nations in their opposition to the fossil fuel industry.
Today we're going to look at some of the highlights and the lowlights in the law for this past year, which we leave behind us with considerable weariness and hope that 2022 will be a better year for progressives. But it's not entirely it's an uneven picture what we see looking back in 2021. And I think as we've taken up so often on the Old Mole and the Left of the Law, that there have been victories as well as stinging defeats. So let's look at the three branches of that govern our lives, the executive, legislative, and judicial branch. And maybe you could start with a brief civics lesson this morning and how these three branches of government produce laws. And then we can look at each and you can kind of lay out some of the notable decisions of 2021.
Well, I'll be real brief. And it's case of the legislature making the laws, the executive branch carrying out the laws or executing the laws, and the court interpreting what the laws mean. And particularly in this country, we have the backdrop of a constitution, which allows the court to reach really far and really deep in terms of what they see, they believe the law to properly mean.
And these branches extend into state and local governing.
Absolutely, yeah. At every level, these three branches interact in the way I just described.
So let's where do you want to start?
Well, let's start with the U.S. Supreme Court, because they have been a disaster. It's been a complete collapse of any hope that the court will ever do anything right. And instead, what we have is a gross expansion of the concept of religious liberty to intrude on rights to of women to regulate their own bodies, of people to join unions, anyone to obtain health care. All these are drastically affected by the U.S. Supreme Court's rulings, interpretations of laws, and expansions of the concept of religious liberty. The year began with a bloodbath. William Barr decided to execute anyone he possibly could within the federal system. And that meant that 13 people were executed, four of them in January after Trump had already lost. The U.S. Supreme Court did nothing to stop any of this, even though several of these people had come up with viable claims that may well have prevailed had they been allowed to present evidence.
Just to explain that point, how many people are on death row in federal prisons, and how often have they been executed historically?
Well, no one's been executed in federal prisons for 20 years for various reasons, including quasi-moratoriums by Obama. And there's been a complete cessation of executions until William Barr decided to fire the system up. And the U.S. Supreme Court has done nothing in the face of laws that would, for example, completely flout the concept of abortion. They've allowed lower courts to proceed. They've even actively intervened in order to overturn courts of appeal that have suspended laws. So they are really on the warpath now. There's no question after the Roe v. Wade oral argument that the right to abortion does not exist.
And it's not a religious liberty for women.
No, not at all. It's not a right of privacy. There is no law that trumps the religious liberty clause. Now we have a hierarchy of rights. A good example is with same-sex marriages, which have been protected now by the U.S. Supreme Court. But that's an inferior right. And if the Catholic Church, which was awarded a contract by the city of Philadelphia to judge whether or not potential foster parents could be good parents, wants to discriminate, then they have the right to do that. Their right trumps the right of people who might want to adopt children. We have now a hierarchy of rights, with religious rights, gun rights, property rights, rising way above any rights having to do with public welfare or health. And I dread what they will do with the vaccination case. They're arguing this very day, January 7th, and we'll get a ruling relatively soon about whether it's okay for the executive branch to require everyone to be vaccinated, or whether someone's religious rights will trump the executive branch's right to manage society.
Let's move to the upside of the picture with what we've just taken up in the left and the law this past year, the movement for progressive district attorneys that came out of the Black Lives Matter movement. Can you say a bit about the upside of the picture and this part of the executive branch?
Well, it's continued to be very successful. The decline of the courts has been matched by a rise in power of progressive prosecutors all over the country. That tendency started a couple of years ago, but it's continued this year with efforts to beat back Larry Krasner, who was the first truly progressive prosecutor. I mean, progressive in the deepest sense, not just nervously bowing every now and then in this direction or that, but really aggressively firing bad prosecutors, implementing a host of discretionary calls, like whether who to prosecute, that are very favorable. And the police union in Philadelphia was outraged. They mounted a big campaign against him. They had their favorite candidate, and Krasner triumphed solidly. efforts to recall Chesa Boudin in San Francisco and George Gascon in Los Angeles have failed. Here in Portland, Mike Schmidt is not as solidly progressive as these, but he's much better than his predecessor and is spending money now, even though in the teeth of the rise in homicides, his spending money on a variety of ways of affecting the community and affecting guns, which make so many disputes into fatal encounters. So yeah, the executive branch of government has been acting much better. And it's a signal for us to build on that, to support that, because the executive branch finally has more power than the courts. You know, the prosecutors every day decide whether or not to charge someone with a crime, and if so, with what crime. And their decisions are on a day-to-day basis, the texture of the laws. The courts, with the exception of aggressive attacks made by courts around the country or by attorneys challenging fossil fuel companies for being liars, the courts have been a place to be defensive only. But the fact that Exxon and other fossil fuel companies were caught 4 years ago with the fact that they had known that climate change was very real since at least the 1990s, and that they've made capital allocation decisions on the basis of that, like determining where they will build what kind of terminals to load and unload oil. At the same time, they were saying publicly that climate change is a big mystery. On the one hand, this, on the other hand, that. We don't know. They knew, and they were acting as if they knew. So people are now suing them for deception of the public and are getting somewhere. They haven't, no one's prevailed yet, but all the efforts of Exxon to have those cases dismissed have been failing all over the country.
I think we also, those of us who are non-Indigenous, owe a tremendous debt to the tribes around the country, particularly in the Northwest, that have fought fossil fuel interests through the courts, through pressing the treaty rights that are built into the U.S. Constitution, that Native tribes in the 19th century and in subsequent cases have fought to defend the right to access to water and resources through what's called usual and accustomed uses of lands. And that these fights that were, of course, were on the public national or global stage with Standing Rock involved fighting the federal government that protected mining interests, that protected the fossil fuel industry, saying that often pipelines and rail lines went through treaty lands, ceded lands that were still protected in terms of access to clean water and resources. So,
well, all over the country, you're right, Jan. Tribes throughout this country have been energetic, smart, and sustained in their litigation. They're holding people to these treaties. Treaties have always been regarded by the U.S. as temporary temporizers, well, this will give me what I want right now. But if it turns out later that we've accidentally extended something important to the tribes, then we'll violate the treaties and nobody will be the wiser. But now the tribes have been using the treaties in a very effective way to protect all of us, basically.
Yeah, so we'll continue to follow many of these cases, particularly as the Biden administration pushes clean energy that opens up a new frontier of mining interests around so-called clean energy and the mining of lithium, copper, cobalt, and other minerals that are seen as critical to the expansion of electric cars. Anything further you would want to say about the judicial branch?
Oh, yeah, I do, Jan. We can't go without hosannas and praises of all sorts to the Oregon Supreme Court, because in a quiet way, and perhaps it would not have happened if it wasn't in a quiet way, more than 30 people on Oregon were effectively removed from the death row, and death row has been dismantled in Oregon. It was a two-step process, really. There was a shift in the death penalty legislation in 2020 when the Oregon legislature got rid of all the categories of aggravated murder that would allow a DA to bring a death sentence, because there have been intense criticism saying that basically it's so wide and inclusive that any single murder in the world can be charged as the death penalty. It's totally arbitrary. And who actually gets to face the end of their life in a trial? So they tightened it up. They got rid of everything that had been in place before and created four new, very narrow, very severe categories of the death penalty. So that change meant that litigation ensued. And this year, the court ruled, because of the precedent, that no single person in any part of this country ever or anywhere else in the world has been actually executed when the law that convicted them was no longer on the books. So all these people who had been convicted and sentenced to death under the old law had their death sentences removed.
Now, you were involved in pressing some of those appeals.
Yes, I was. But the main people who did the work were Jeff Ellis and Renee Manis of the Federal Public Defender's Office, Rich Wolf. Yeah, there were lots of people who coordinated this effort and have been fighting really effectively for many years against Oregon's death penalty.
This is part of the broader Black Lives Matter movement. Many activists involved in police politics describe themselves as abolitionists, and abolitionism has taken some heavy hits this year. But you're saying there, the larger picture also includes advances as people become more conscious of the racism that's baked into the judicial criminal justice system.
Well, yeah, there has been, as you know, a ferocious backlash, as there always is whenever Black people advance in any way in this country. But there have been legislative victories, laws, for example, tightening up the right of prosecutors to dismiss African Americans from juries. That's been a routine use by the executive branch of their power to select juries, is to get rid of any minority people. It's quite clear that, according to surveys, African Americans are 20% less likely to support a death sentence. So DAs, even if they're not personally, you know, rabid racists, will still want to get rid of any African-American in order to obtain a conviction. And it's gotten somewhat more difficult due to laws passed in three states that I know of. But basically, yeah, it's been an up and down year, an effort to consolidate the gains made in 2020 after the murder of George Floyd. But this year, the actual banning of books related to something called critical race theory, which has been expanded now to include anything that suggests that America was ever racist, has been a strong counterpunch from people defending white supremacy. And the results are, you know, going back and forth. It's very much an issue on the cutting edge of both legislative and executive branch of government.
To sum up 2021 and to look forward to the landscape ahead, the legal landscape for progressives for 2022, where do you see the legal ground where we should be fighting, if not reforming the Supreme Court, and the courts are less and less a place to seek justice? Where do you think we need to be fighting?
Well,
where should we put our barricades?
Well, the courts are largely a lost cause. You know, Trump appointed 12 of the 27 judges in the Ninth Circuit now. The federal courts have become something to avoid rather than to use. Executive branch of government is open, wide open. People have been persuaded by all the DNA cases of exoneration that the crime and punishment is government work after all, that there are mistakes made, that it is racist. There have been so many films made. There's the TikTok and YouTube are just filled with instances of blatant racism. There are possibilities here to get better prosecutors elected, to get better laws passed, and to work on the ground in local communities and from the ground up work to make a better world.
Okay, well, that's a good way to end the year as old moles working from the ground up. We'll continue to report in the upcoming year. Hopefully we'll have more highlights than lowlights.
Thanks much, Jen.
Happy New Year.
That does it for our show. I want to thank Moles Sharon Grant, Bill Resnick, Jan Hocken, and Mike Snedeker for their contributions today, Denise Morris for her editing assistance, and our guest, Malik Mia. And as always, thanks to the hardworking staff for keeping KABU on the air. This is Patricia Kullberg, and I've been your host for this hour of recognition for Martin Luther King Jr. Tune in again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. And thanks for listening. Please stay safe and stay active. I'd like to leave you this morning with this music by Ambrose Akinmusiri. It's called Hooded Procession, Read the Names Out Loud, and was composed as a remembrance to all Black victims of racist violence.